Father, we thank you so much, God, that you bring us here, Lord, to fill us with your word, to, Lord, teach us, to grow us in our knowledge of you, to grow us in our love for you. Lord, I pray that you would use this time for that purpose to speak to us now through your word, to work in and through our lives, to draw us closer to yourself, to continue, Lord, in rejecting the temptations of our flesh, to follow you, to, Lord, know you better and love you deeper. Lord, speak clearly through me, through your word right now. I pray that we would not only understand it, but that we would apply it. We would live this out and live it to your glory in Jesus' name. Amen. So something I believe we can all admit, if we're being honest, that we've all had a problem with at one point or another is authority. There's reasons for that. Amongst human beings, authority tends to be a little imperfect, shall we say. Doesn't mean it's bad. God tells us to submit to authority. But we've all kind of had our bad brushes with authority figures before, have we not? Perhaps it's the authority of a parent telling you, no, you cannot take the bag of Cheeto Puffs back to your room at 11 p.m., even though you saw them put it back in the pantry with their Cheeto dust-stained fingers at 10:59. Perhaps it's the authority of a teacher telling you that they won't accept your late assignment, even though the kid in front of you just turned in their late assignment with no issue. Perhaps it's the authority of a coach telling you to run a few extra laps at practice, even though it looks like he hasn't run a lap since 1985. Yep. We've all had our bad brushes with authority before, have we not? But what if there's authority that we have no reason to take issue with? What if there's authority that we have no grounds to protest? What if there's authority that's exercised perfectly? No hypocrisy, no double standards, no compromises. Say what they mean what they say, and they actually live it out themselves. Authority that, because it's not hypocritical, because it has one standard, because it's not compromising, it's perfectly exercised in every fashion. What if that authority exists? Well, it does. And it must be submitted to perfectly. Would we perfectly submit to that kind of authority? Authority that, again, is perfect and doesn't betray its own standard? Would we actually honestly obey that all the time? I'll be honest, I don't believe we really would perfectly submit and be obedient to that kind of authority. Because such authority does exist, and we don't perfectly submit to it. There is such authority. His name is Jesus, and we still sin against him and disbelieve his authority on a daily basis. So we're going to learn a bit more about that authority. I think we all could use that. So this morning in our To Serve Man series through the Gospel of Mark, we're going to see the first of three consecutive stories here in this gospel, all of which highlight the authority, the power of Jesus as our God. Each of these displays of authority are going to show Jesus' power over a unique element, a unique part of life here on earth, a unique part of physical life, spiritual life, so on. Today's few verses we have at the end of chapter 4, we're going to look at Jesus' authority showcased within nature, showing us that as the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, he serves here, his disciples, in such a way that, honestly, by the end of it, it just kind of leaves them shook. They don't really know what to do with it. So let's dig into that a little bit. Let's look here, beginning in verse 35 of Mark chapter 4. Mark writes here, on the same day, when evening had come, he said to them, let us cross over to the other side. Now, when they had left the multitude, they took him along in the boat as he was, and other little boats were also with him. And a great windstorm arose, and the waves beat into the boat so that it was already filling. But he was in the stern, asleep on a pillow. And they awoke him and said to him, teacher, do you not care that we are perishing? Then he arose and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, peace, be still. And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm. But he said to them, why are you so fearful? How is it that you have no faith? And they feared exceedingly and said to one another, who can this be that even the wind and the sea obey him? We see at the end of this passage, considering not only just these verses, but really everything we've gone over in Mark up to this point. The disciples of Jesus have seen a lot up to this point. They've seen healings that he's done. They've heard him teach. They've seen him cast demons out by this point. They've seen Jesus do a lot of things that clearly no ordinary human had ever done the way he did it. There should have been kind of a light bulb moment for them of who Jesus is. And yet, by the end of these verses, we find they've completely neglected the reality of who Jesus is. The Son of God, the Messiah, God in human flesh. He has full, total authority, which by the end of this gospel, he will have reiterated to his disciples. And this means full and total authority over everything. Full, total authority in all things. He is God. All things submit to him. And in these verses, we'll find what that submission looks like in the elements of nature. How it leads to something even further. How it leads to something even greater. How the authority of Jesus over nature points to his authority in all things. So let's look here at two forces Jesus demonstrates authority over. Number one, if you're taking note, we have it on the screens for you. Number one is weather. Jesus demonstrates authority over the weather. Quite literally, the element of nature here at work. What's remarkable here in this story is that it's not Jesus standing up and waving his hand like some sort of conductor for the storm to stop. It's not like Jesus raises his hand and commands it to quiet and then stop. There's nothing weird like that. Jesus uses his word. He says, peace be still, and it's done. That's it. He speaks to the weather, and the weather listens. And number two, the other force we see Jesus demonstrate authority over here is doubt. This might be stretching it a little bit. We see Jesus having his authority over human nature here. This is the even further, the even greater here at play. If you saw in the verses we just read, Jesus' authority over the weather pointed even to his authority over the doubts of his own disciples, over the doubts of mankind. But firstly, we'll focus on earthly nature here. Jesus demonstrating his authority over the weather. Look at verses 36 and 37 here with me. Now, when they had left the multitude, they took him along in the boat as he was, and other little boats were also with him. And a great windstorm arose, and the waves beat into the boat so that it was already filling. This is taking place here. This particular story is at the end of the very same day Jesus has just wrapped up teaching so many parables, which we've read throughout Mark chapter 4. The parable of the sower, the parable of the growing seed, the mustard seed, all of those that we've spent the last couple of weeks studying. Jesus taught all of that in one shot. And now, on that very same day, Jesus and his disciples are setting sail across the Sea of Galilee. It's even believed that as Jesus was teaching, he was teaching on the shore of the sea, standing in a boat that was washed ashore, with the crowd gathered around on the beach, so to speak, in front of him. And now he and his disciples pushed out onto the water. Now, the Sea of Galilee itself, understanding a lot about the Sea of Galilee is central to this story, to understanding what's going on. I don't blame anybody in here for not being familiar with the geography of the Middle East. I'm certainly not. So that means we got to study a little bit. The Sea of Galilee there in Israel has always been prone to very sudden, violent, stormy conditions. It's because of the way that that sea is situated. It's actually a lake. Technically speaking, the Sea of Galilee is a freshwater lake surrounded on all sides by land. It's situated in a very low valley. In fact, the second lowest point on planet Earth. And it's surrounded by these plateaus, these rolling hills. And with how it's situated kind of in a valley, warm air kind of settles right over the Sea of Galilee, So anytime colder winds blow in, they rush down those rolling hills, off those plateaus, down toward the sea. And for any of you who have ever paid attention in earth science before, when cold air meets warm air in nature, storms happen, right? Tornadoes, wind, violent conditions. And that's what happens here. Many of Jesus' disciples, if you remember, were fishermen at one point. In fact, the first four that he called to himself, if you remember way back in Mark chapter 1, all of them were fishermen. They had fished in the sea countless times. Very likely, they were familiar with the conditions of the weather there. Very likely, they had been caught in more than one storm while they fished. This wasn't an unfamiliar place for them to be in. What caused this situation to escalate so much? Number one, the rest of the disciples with them were not fishermen. Much less likely they'd experienced this before. And number two, this was a particular storm so violent that it wasn't like they were just kind of hitting some turbulence, if you will. This wasn't like a couple of guys got nauseous and just threw up over the side of the boat. This thing was going so tossed to and fro, the waves of the sea were actually crashing into the boat. And not like, oh no, a little bit of water splashed on my shoes, now my feet are wet. It was, the boat was filling with water. The Greek word gemizestai is used for filling, literally meaning to be filled entirely, the way you're filling up a cup to take a drink out of it. The boat was not just getting wet, it was filling with water. It was a very dangerous situation. The safety of everybody, on board was jeopardized. It was the kind of storm that could have flooded or sunk or capsized this little boat. Full, terrifying, stormy conditions going on. The disciples are very scared. And Jesus is taking a nap. I'm impressed by that. I got to be honest with you. Just on its face, before we get into like the specifics of how and why, Jesus napping in the back of the boat on a pillow while this is all going on, I'm very impressed. Some of you might know, my wife, Kelly, has been gifted with this incredible ability that I'm slightly jealous of, to fall asleep anywhere in any conditions. I don't get how she does it. She's explained it to me a million times. I still can't comprehend it. She'll fall asleep anywhere. It's almost like it's on command. Music could be playing in the room at maximum volume. The lights could all be on and my kids could be playing and screaming as loud as they've ever been. She's knocked out if she's tired enough. She could be sitting straight up in the passenger seat of the car. She could be laying back on an airplane, having her seat kicked by a kid behind her. She could be leaning against the wall. Doesn't matter. She'll fall asleep. It's insane. But even that does not hold a candle to what Jesus is doing here. Deadly storm, like deadliest catch level type of stuff. He's knocked out. Like it's nothing. The boat's filling with water. I don't know about you, but I wouldn't be able to sleep when wet. That would just bother me on a different level. Jesus is knocked out. According to verse 38, he's literally on a pillow in the back of the boat. In his humanity, remember Jesus being fully man and fully God. In his humanity, dude, he was tired. Been a long day. He taught for a long time. He was out in the sun for a long time. He was tired. But in his authority as God, catch this, in his authority as God, his sleep was assurance of his complete control over what was going on. Even before, long before Jesus stood up and told the storm, "Peace, be still," he was in control. His sleep was evidence that he was in control. The fact that the Sea of Galilee was raging at its worst, and Jesus is asleep with no sense of panic, completely at peace, is assurance of his complete control and authority over what was going on. But Jesus did not remain asleep, because his disciples did what many of us would have done when we were 5 years old and scared in the middle of the night. The way that any of us would have run into our parents' room and done everything we could to wake at least one of them up, if not both, the disciples did to Jesus. They're scared out of their minds. They go and wake him up. They were most definitely in a state of panic, without any peace, and unassured of any sort of safety or control over what was going on. In fact, at the end of verse 38, they say something pretty bold to Jesus. They say, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" This is not them saying, "Teacher, help us." This is not them saying, "Jesus, we're afraid." This is beyond their own emotions. They're calling the character of Jesus into question. They're saying, "Jesus, don't you care that we're literally about to die? Do you understand what's going on here? Why are you sleeping?" Conveying almost as much annoyance and frustration as there is fear. Now, in that sort of a situation, if I was being talked to like that at that moment, me personally, I wouldn't take that level of disrespect. I'd have some words. I'm sure many of us might feel the same if we're being completely honest about ourselves. Like, "You really want to talk to me like that right now? Like, is this the time or the place?" But Jesus doesn't address the disciples yet. First, he turns to the weather. We see in verse 39, "Then he arose and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, 'Peace, be still.' And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm." At the word of Jesus, at his very command, in an instant, the storm goes from violent, life-threatening, and dangerous to non-existent. It's gone. The wind and the waves obey Jesus. And that should be a clear testimony to us of his authority. That should speak volumes of who Jesus is. But here's the application of it. We think about Jesus being asleep during a raging storm. We think about Jesus silencing a raging storm once he's been woken up. And we think about how the disciples were acting during both of those situations. How many of us only find peace and contentment in Jesus when there's calm? How many of us are not at peace and are not content knowing he's in control, knowing he has authority, because the storm of whatever it is in life is still going on? How many of us see what's going on in our lives, the chaos, the unpredictability, the fear of it all? And we feel like Jesus, just like he was on the boat, is just asleep. Maybe we see our parents on the brink of divorce, and we've prayed all the way through the process that maybe, just maybe, something would happen to where the Lord just gets a hold of the both of them and they figure it out. They work it out. We lose friends at school. We brace ourselves for whatever level of bullying or harassment or just loneliness we're going to feel that day, and feel like every time we ask for God to help, nothing happens. Nothing changes. We interpret the lack of the answer we're looking for as if Jesus doesn't care. Let me assure you today, he cares. Just as the disciples asked, "Teacher, do you not care?" Of course Jesus cares. He sees it all. He knows it all start to finish. He's in tune to what's going on in our lives far more than we tend to think. But could it be that his choice to leave the trials and storms of life in their place is a sign that he is, in fact, in control of them? Not a sign that he doesn't care, not a sign that he doesn't understand or doesn't see it, but rather a sign that he's still in control of it all. If Jesus isn't panicked, why are we? Jesus sees the whole situation start to finish. We don't. That alone should encourage us. If he sees everything start to finish, he knows how this will end. I just need to trust him. But if we truly love and trust in Jesus, we shouldn't interpret his waiting to act as if it's failure to act. His authority over the weather proved he was in control all along. Whether he was asleep or whether he actively silenced the storm, in both ways, he maintained power over it. Because just as much as he brought it to stop in an instant, he did allow it to continue. It didn't continue without his permission, because he was using it. God is in control of our trials just as much when he ends them, as much as he is when they're still going and when they're at their worst. we must remember that. He has authority. He has control, regardless of if it feels like he does or doesn't. Regardless of if we see evidence that he does or doesn't. And to that end, leading right into that, secondly, we see Jesus demonstrate his authority over doubt. Now, if you guys have been with us for any length of time, you know I'd like to put the title, the text, the outline of our notes on the screens for you. I'm a visual person. I like visual aids. It makes it easier to follow along. I like to provide that same liberty for you guys. And you'll notice when I give the outline, I typically will list the verses with each point. You're like, wait, there's no verses up there. How do we know where we're at? Both of these forces that Jesus demonstrates his authority over are addressed simultaneously. That's why I didn't put verses by them. They're addressed together. So we're going to read all of these verses one more time. You'll notice if you did notice anyway, when we were going over the point of whether, we picked a few verses out. Now we're going to put them all together and in turn put this all together. On the same day, it says, when evening had come, he said to them, let us cross over to the other side. Hold on to verse 35 and remember it as we continue. Now, when they had left the multitude, they took him along in the boat as he was, and other little boats were also with him. And a great windstorm arose, and the waves beat into the boat so that it was already filling. But he was in the stern, asleep on a pillow. And they awoke him and said to him, teacher, do you not care that we are perishing? Then he arose and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, peace, be still. And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm. But he said to them, why are you so fearful? How is it that you have no faith? And they feared exceedingly and said to one another, who can this be that even the wind and the sea obey him? So how do we know that this is genuine doubt on the part of the disciples, as opposed to just kind of a moment of fear that just emotionally got out of hand? Remember, I told you to hold on to verse 35. There's something Jesus says there. Let us cross over to the other side. Now, we have the advantage here 2,000 years later of knowing who Jesus is. We know Jesus is God. His word is binding. Every word he speaks is a promise. Jesus said they'd get to the other side of the sea. That should be reason enough to believe it will happen. Up to this point, Jesus had never misled the disciples, and he wasn't about to begin here. He'd never misled them, and he was never going to mislead them. Regardless of what happens in the in-between, they were going to get there. Jesus never said, let us cross over smoothly to the other side. He said, let us cross over to the other side. There's a promise they're going to get there. He wouldn't say that just from the die halfway there, just for them to get stranded or have the boat turn over. Now consider also, on top of that, kind of some logical factors at play here. The Sea of Galilee is one of the largest lakes in the world, but even at this point, it was only 5 miles wide, the part they were crossing. It was less than a day's journey, even on a little fishing boat. This wasn't the ocean. The distance they were covering was not unreasonable. The logical factors even seemed to line up. But independent of that, the word of Jesus ought to have been enough. He said they'd go to the other side. That was not about to change. But the disciples forgot what Jesus said as soon as that storm hit. And isn't that so often the case? They forgot the promise. They forgot the truth because the situation got tough. Now they were in danger. Now they were panicked. Verse 38 shows us just how much they doubted Jesus' earlier promise to them that they'd get to the other side because they don't even ask, Jesus, you said we'd get to the other side. What's happening? They don't even call the promise into question. They call his character into question. Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing? In the Greek, the idea of perishing literally means to fully destroy. The disciples see they're in a situation, a scary one. No one's denying this is a serious situation. There's no denying that it's a scary situation, but are they really being fully destroyed? Not right here. Definitely in no situation where Jesus is present. Not with the promise he made to his disciples, they would indeed cross over and get to the other side. He's God. He can't lie. He doesn't deceive. He wouldn't tell them they'd cross over just for them to not make it. But again, the disciples forgot what Jesus said as soon as the storm hit. And isn't that so often the case? We forget Jesus' promises. We forget the truth of his word because of how bad a situation feels, how much danger we feel like we're in, or how much danger we might actually be in. And so we panic. We forget that God is a promise keeper. We forget that God is good. We forget that God does not lie. We forget that God does not betray his word. And when the going gets tough, we panic. We freak out. We try to bail ourselves out of the situation. We try to get out of it on our own effort. We try to fix our own situation apart from God because we neglect his promises. We forget what God says as soon as trials and hard times come into our lives. And the disciples here, they not only forgot what Jesus said about the storm and about crossing over to the other side, they doubted his love and care. I know I keep mentioning that, but there's a reason. We've got to consider it. The disciples doubted the core of who Jesus is. Again, teacher, do you not care that we are perishing? They doubt his concern and love for them. As if God's love for us is dependent on our life being easy. As if God's love for us is dependent on our situations always being convenient. God's love is unchanging in its measure, in terms of how much, and in its completeness, in terms of how deep. God's love and care do not change just because we're in danger. God's love and care and concern for us do not change just because the situation we're in is something we don't like or don't want to deal with. That's why after he calms the storm, he silences both the wind and the waves, then he addresses the disciples in verse 40. Why are you so fearful? How is it that you have no faith? You guys, if God incarnate looked me right in the eyes and said, why are you so fearful? How do you have no faith? I'd drop where I stood. That is it for me. I'm done. Mind you, Jesus isn't condemning the disciples here in any way. He's not rebuking the fact that they were afraid as they got battered by this storm in their little boat. It's not that the storm wasn't scary. Jesus wasn't saying they were being a bunch of sissies and they needed to get over it. He wasn't telling them they overreacted and got all emotional for no reason. There was something genuinely fearful going on. That was a healthy recognition that this storm was powerful and that these disciples were not. They knew that about themselves. What he rebukes in the disciples is the fact that they stayed in their fear and they let their fear control their response. He didn't condemn them being afraid. He rebuked the fact that they acted upon it. They feared to the point of distrust in Jesus. They feared to the point of doubting his goodness, doubting his promise that they would indeed make it. It's completely right, completely justified for Jesus here to ask them, how do they have no faith? I mean, think of what they've witnessed already, just walking with Jesus on a daily basis. They've seen demons cast out. They've seen people healed from the brink of death. They've seen him teach like no other person had ever taught before. But how quickly they forget when they fixate on their fears. How quickly we doubt who God is. How quickly we doubt the power and the authority of God when we fixate on our fears. How quickly we turn away from and ignore the promises of God, the nature of God, all because we're stressed or afraid or tired. How quickly we neglect his word because we're distracted by the trials of life or even just by the daily routine of life. And yet all of our doubt, our neglect, our ignorance, our forgetfulness, our fear, our anxiety. None of those things stop God. None of those things get in his way. It doesn't hold a candle to him. He's God. Of course, Jesus has authority over doubt because nothing stops him. Our doubts don't get in the way of God's will. Who are we to think we're so powerful that our emotions are going to stop God from having his way? Our doubts are not going to stop him. Our doubts are not going to prevent God from doing a single thing. He's God and we're not. Our doubts about God's goodness, his power, his care, his love, they're never justified. Our doubts about God don't reveal a lack within God. They reveal a lack within us. Our doubts reveal a lack of faith, a lack of trust in who God says he is. And then the disciples ask an important question in verse 41, kind of that starting to put it together moment. Who can this be that even the wind and the sea obey him? Personally, I believe this had to have been the moment where the disciples started putting together who Jesus really was. This had to have been the moment it started to come together for them. Again, we have to be reminded at this point in time, we don't have any record that the disciples knew at this moment Jesus was the Messiah. But it had to be clear by this point he was not just another teacher. It had to be clear by this point he was not merely a prophet. He was not Elijah reincarnate. Jesus didn't say, in the name of God, peace be still. He didn't speak on the authority of another. He spoke on his own authority and simply said, peace be still. And the storm was over. He spoke on his own authority because the answer to who can this be is that Jesus is the Messiah. He is God in human flesh. This would only get more and more evident, more and more clear as Jesus continued displaying his authority, as he continued to teach and to heal and to perform miracles. We'll see later on in this Gospel of Mark, particularly when we get to chapter 8, Peter himself will confess with witnesses around that Jesus is the Messiah, the one who came to rule and to reign and also to lay his life down for us. I mentioned several weeks ago, if you remember, a central theme of the Gospel of Mark is this idea of Jesus as a servant king. One who came to rule in his first coming to the earth, but also coming to serve. We also find another theme regarding who Jesus is, the concept of the suffering servant. One who came not to be served, but to serve and to suffer. How? By giving his life a ransom for many. That's Mark 10:45. Arguably the theme verse of the entire gospel. And he came to serve, he came to suffer, both in the ultimate sense in one action, and that is suffering the death of the cross for the sins of the world. The place where he would conquer every enemy, where he would crush every doubt, demonstrate authority over every force, because it was on the cross where he defeated sin. It was in the grave where he defeated death. I mean, think about that for just a second. He defeated sin upon the cross. He defeated death within the grave. He went into enemy territory and defeated those forces on their home ground. Any of you who are sports fans, you know the magnitude of a team winning a game when they go into their enemies, their rivals' stadium with all of their rivals' fans and just lay a royal beat down upon them. In any NFL game where the visiting team goes into the home stadium and wins 50-0, you know that visiting team is legit. You don't question it. Jesus went to the cross, which was reserved for the worst of all criminals in the Roman Empire. It was not the method of execution they used for everybody. They reserved it for the highest of enemies, committing the worst of felonies. Jesus went there and beat sin. Jesus went to the grave where the dead are laid for good in terms of their physicality and defeated death. He conquered sin and death on their own domains. And he suffered in doing so. He suffered physically, being beaten, being bruised, being bloodied beyond anything we could ever dream of in our greatest of nightmares. He suffered emotionally, being mocked, being stripped and publicly displayed naked as the soldiers who killed him gambled for his clothing. He suffered spiritually, taking the sin of the world upon himself and being separated from the Father in heaven for the first and only time. And in his suffering, he served mankind by making a way to be justified and made right with God. And in his suffering, he demonstrated in the ultimate sense his authority over all things, over every force that can ever be. As we prepare to partake of communion here in just a little bit, remember that. Remember what Jesus has done. Remember the truth of who he is. Remember the truth of who Jesus is, of what Jesus has done. And remember that that doesn't depend on the circumstances of life. It doesn't depend on whether our lives are individually going well or not. His love, his power are not contingent on whether we're in danger. Remember that he is God no matter where we find ourselves. Remember that he is in control of all things, whether we visibly see that control in action or not. Remember, his control is not dependent on whether he answers our prayers the way we want him to. Remember, he is God. Remember, he is good. Remember, he has died and risen again to buy us back from sin and death, to be reunited forevermore with himself, to demonstrate his authority over all things. And so, Lord, help us to recognize your authority over all things, your authority over sin, your authority over death, demonstrated, illustrated here in the very verses that we've read. The story of you calming the wind and the waves as your disciples cowered and were fearful to the point of doubting your very character. Lord, help us to remember that in every trial and in every season of life, you're in control just as much when things don't look like they're changing as you are when things are definitely changing. You're just as much in control whether we're doubting or whether we're praising. But Lord, you don't call us to doubt who you are. You don't call us to doubt what you're doing. You call us to believe, to put our faith and our trust in what you're doing, even and especially when we don't see it. To know that you are working when we don't see how you're working. That is faith. That is what you've called us to. And so as we prepare to partake of communion here together, Lord, I pray that each of us, where we are, would recognize you're in control, whether we see it or not. You're leading us, whether you see it or not. Lord, help us to recognize that we're where we are at all because of what you've done for us upon the cross. To recognize that your death, your resurrection, have made the way for us to even be here right now, studying your word, growing in your truth, and how we apply it to our lives. It is all because of you. Help us to recognize your authority over all things, including over our lives, over the very things we do and say and think about, and live according to your authority on those things. What you tell us is true, what you tell us is good, what you tell us is evil, what you tell us is sin. And that we would turn from those things and avoid them and live for the purpose of pleasing you. And Lord, let this be done to your honor and to your glory. In Jesus' name, amen.